On this week's show, Finding the Magic Bullet with Thomas Santos and Shabini Alford from Maxim Consulting. Yeah, we're back, baby. Thomas is with us. Shabini's with us. Shabini, I always love sitting down with you. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Jeff? I've missed you.
I'm excited. I've missed you, too. I couldn't get connected, but now we're connected.
Yes, finally.
And you brought Thomas with us. Thomas, it's great to have you here, man.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad she thought of me when she was thinking about this.
Well, when we were talking about it, I was thinking, this is going to be fun. We're going to have a lot of fun. I think you guys are going to enjoy this show as you're listening in. But you guys know the drill. Check us out on YouTube, youtube.com/@thecontechcrew. Follow us on the social medias. We've been at events. We're going to do some wrap-ups for the year, so stay tuned. Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the Contech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@thecontechcrew.com to learn more. All right, we're back. Okay, so I know my listeners know a little bit about Shabini, but we're going to give them a catch up in a second. But Thomas, you're new to the show, so why don't you give us a little rundown of who you are and what brought you here today?
Just a quick background thing, mechanical engineer training right after getting out of the military. So I got a lot of leadership experience there. And then eventually got my MBA. So I wanted a mix of technical and business acumen. Been in manufacturing for about 35 years as a lean practitioner, a Six Sigma trained. Yeah, I mean, I got a lot of paper on the wall, which kind of goes out the window once I get my feet on the ground talking with people. But probably the last 10 years of my 40-year career has been in construction, where a construction company actually reached out to me to say, hey, man, we don't know what you know. Can you bring that over? And that's kind of what started my journey in the construction world, the MEP side of everything. So I love it because there's a lot of fertile ground. There's a lot of application, a lot of education. So right down my alley. I love this stuff.
That's awesome, actually. Back in the day, and as we've gone through this evolution for the trades, we've been saying, like, you really can't take field foremen, you know, people from the field and bring them into the shop and make them into manufacturers. It's like an old joke. And if, hey, anybody hit me on social media if you know where this one came from, but that's like asking a chef, hey, you're a great chef. Can you farm? Like, no, I can't. Now, ultimately, there's some differences, and we'll dive into those a little bit. But that's the, you know how to manufacture, but those manufacturing parts are usually then sold as is. In our world, they have to be assembled. So I'm wondering, it's probably a big piece of the learning for you, right?
I guess the ultimate difference, to me, there is no difference. And even in manufacturing within a shop, like prefab, for instance, I'm still taking raw material, converting it. I don't sell it. I install it. So the customer has to be installed instead of just being happy with what they bought. So to me, it's the same mentality, same idea. Manufacturing has been doing this for way, way too long. And it's been tested, proved. You know, I've been blessed enough to teach this all over the world. You know, countries that don't even speak English, like Indonesia, India, China, Japan, Philippines. If we can get these concepts across globally, we should be able to do it within MEP.
I think what I hear the most is, but we're different from manufacturing because we build something different every single time.
Yeah, right? That's on that.
And exactly.
We're going to have a fun with Thomas here in a minute. I have a feeling there's some people getting ready to throw some things at their windshields while they drive here. Before we get there, Shabini, for those that don't know you, catch them up a little bit. You have been on the show, but it's been a while.
It has been. I think it's been like 5 or 6 years. Might have been 2019, 2020, something like that. It was at MCA Innovation in San Diego a long time ago. But I'm Shabini Alford. Some might refer to me as the MCA poster child. I came up through the student chapter, went through all the local classes here in Southern California with CPMCA. Went to IPM, AIPM, ALI, sat on the board of directors, taught at IPM, worked for a large mechanical contractor here in Southern California, did 20 years in the industry in the corporate world, and then essentially retired a few years ago. And I was doing a couple of speaking engagements for friends that asked. And then Maxim called and said, hey, why don't you do more of it and do it with us? And so I've been doing that for the last 2 years, running some peer groups and doing a lot of speaking engagements at the conferences, conventions, local associations.
Yeah, that's, you know, getting the education, getting the word out. You have a lot of experience. I love that, the poster child for MCAA, the career that can be made if you make it. So that is awesome. So Maxim, who wants to take what it kind of give a little plug? What is Maxim and what's their goal right now?
Thanks, Thomas. So Maxim, we like to say we're a boutique consulting firm. So we're not like some of the other really large consulting firms. We're not taking college kids right out of college and putting them in your company and having them tell you how to run your job. The reason we're boutique is we're small. There's only about 10 of us directors, like Thomas and myself, and we all came from the industry. We all have at least 20 years experience being in the MEP construction manufacturing world. So that's what sets us apart. We do a lot of speaking engagements, like I just mentioned, a lot of lean, BDC, ERP implementation stuff. We have Maxim Capital that helps with mergers and acquisitions, succession planning, captive insurance. And I think the biggest thing, value that we bring is peer groups. And so we have over 35 active peer groups. There are some that are general contractors paving windows, but a bulk of the peer groups that we run are NEP based. And so for a lot of SMACNA, NECA, MCAA contractors.
Right up your alley and 20 years of experience there. That's a valuable group of people with a lot of experience that I like that idea too. It's taking people at the right point of their career. And we've been saying this, it's like, we're all doing one to many when we're at our companies. It's now an opportunity, or one to one when we're at our companies. It's now an opportunity to be one to many and sort of facilitate that conversation. And those peer groups are huge because, again, we were talking pre-call, but my sort of thing right now is unlocking the collective intelligence. And that's what happens when you put those peer groups together. You're facilitating great innovation and change, but also, you know, as Thomas can jump in and say, like, a little bit of the fundamentals, a little bit of, you're not actually a snowflake. You're not at, like, hey, maybe a little, like, this doesn't need to actually be solved by inventing a new rocket ship. Like, maybe this has been done. So let's talk about sort of what brought you here. Cause like we said, I hadn't talked in a while. Shabini dropped a note and said, hey, we're seeing this problem. And can we just like talk about it for a little bit? So Thomas, what would you say that problem that we're talking about, cause you found the magic bullet, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The magic bullet, like we said earlier, right, I think is between your ears. It's in your brain. We have to figure this out. I think if I went to a high enough level, the problem that we're trying to solve for here is the inefficiencies that we see in our market sector. You can't go to these gigantic consulting groups like McKinsey or Boston Consulting or whatever and find out, you know, where is the construction efficiency? They're always giving you numbers like 30%, 40%. So when somebody says, hey, I need a tool to go after my inefficiencies, it's like, if you're only 40% effective, inefficiencies is the majority of what we do. So first of all, is understanding that, right? And so this particular case, we're looking at value stream mapping, right? You know, VSM, which is just one of many tools within the lean basket. So, you know, I always like to take things up a notch where, you know, I'm always going to ask the new guy, what is it that you're trying to solve, right? Problem definition is key, right? That, you know, thank God for my engineering background. If I don't bound this problem, then I'm trying to solve for the universe, which is impossible. And then Shabini can talk to this better than I can. She runs these groups, you know, what kind of frustrations they feel, what's the angst. Why aren't they getting what they are getting? Why is it hard to get an ROI? I mean, she gets to hear all of that, right? And I'm the guy with the magic bullet that helps them find it.
I like it. When you hear that, Shabini, you've been out in the field for a long time. And by the way, I'm stealing that, Thomas. We're 40% productive, which means we actually specialize in inefficiency. So I'm stealing that. And I love the McKinsey thing. Like, no offense to McKinsey, but they're, you know, those numbers are for marketing. that they want you to come and get the consulting. You know, I challenge them over and over, but they don't come on my little show. So I get to talk to you guys. So talk a little bit about connecting that to the problem itself, Shabini, and how this is working in with you.
So I think we can all agree there isn't one software that will apply to all of our MEPs. That just doesn't exist, right? And so I see a lot of companies that are bridging together solutions, which is great, right? But what I also see is as they're investing a ton of time and money, resources, and implementing, you know, the new softwares, I ask, okay, well, what are our standard operating procedures? What are the written, you know, rules of engagement, especially as companies are growing and they're onboarding new people? What is the way that XYZ company does it, right? Where's your protocols? And a lot of them say, well, we don't have that. Well, how are we integrating new technology and just adding more workload on top and new processes and procedures without having actual written documentation of how it's supposed to be done or where we were trying to solve for a problem, right? When I reached out to you and to Thomas, I was like, listen, and I said this in the first podcast that I was on with you, I'm not a tech person. I'm an operations person. But for me, it's hard to accept the fact that the people that I see are looking for that magic solution to have software solve their problems when they haven't really identified what the problem is and where that workflow isn't working or why the workflow isn't working.
Yeah, you hit a really key component there of why software on the other side is struggling as well. Because if you don't have those standard operating procedures, then we're going to come in and fit you to our mold in the way we know it. And then the other one that you're bolting in is going to fit you to their mold and going to fit you to that mold. And all of a sudden, you're some monster that you weren't when you started. And you wonder why you're less efficient and it doesn't feel good.
The other thing I've noticed is because we don't have that, what I've seen companies do is customize, 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 customize. And then all of a sudden, they're so specialized and customized. It's like if you had left the application out of the box, it probably would work better than what you've done to it now.
Well, Shabini, this is what we talked about, right? We talked about this before the show. Like if I'm inefficient now and I'm wasting $1 an hour by automating that process and getting the next shiny object or the cool software, now I'm wasting $10 an hour because I just made my inefficiency that much better. So understanding the problem is so important.
And it is. And I like the fact that you said earlier about binding the problem, right? Because if you don't put constraints on it, then you're solving for everything. And that's literally what we hear a lot said to the innovation team, the construction technologists is like, figure it all out. It's like, no, that's not how this works. So explain, Thomas, what, you know, binding the problem and then what maybe some of those steps are towards truly getting on the path to solving the problem.
I mean, so if we stay at the topic at hand, right? So value stream mapping. Why do I want value stream mapping? What problem am I trying to solve? So value stream mapping, like I said before, is just one tool of many within Lean. But what does it do? It exposes hidden ways. Hey, that's a good one because we keep talking about our inefficiencies. Okay. It helps align teams. Because wherever a team connects to another team, there's a handoff that has to happen. And that's brutally inefficient in our industry. I spend most of my time at those intersections. What else does it do? It can create a future vision, a future map, because you're getting a picture of where I am today. And in my head, I have a vision of where I want to be tomorrow. And then the difference between those two, you know, in Lean, we just call that a gap, right? So that's the gap analysis that we're trying to solve for. And that gap is where you build your roadmap. And then ultimately, if I do my job well, I can try to help instill this culture of continuous improvement. And what do I mean by that? That we celebrate when we find problems. We don't beat people up when we find problems. A lot of times what you see in, you know, in the field, if a journeyman or an apprentice, for instance, you know, maybe put something together wrong, then you get your foreman who's an old school guy and he likes to share DNA with you. So he's like kind of spitting all over your face. And what we're trying to do is get rid of that punitive approach where every time I find an issue, it gives me an opportunity to solve a problem. And if I have an organization that's, you know, foundationally within continuous improvement, we all learn. So the organization just got a little bit smart versus that one guy or one gal who learned it and now she does that really well. That's tribal knowledge. It's not institutionalized. It doesn't help anybody. So okay, VSM is a good tool because it kind of covers a lot of things that I'm struggling with, right? Vision. Do I even have a vision? The roadmap. Do I even have a roadmap? Are we all pointed to true north, or is one guy going this way and one girl going that way? And then we're all chasing those inefficiencies, because it's a funny thing about inefficiencies with an organization, because it's costing you dollars. Every dollar that you save within an inefficiency, that's not a fake dollar. This isn't accounting trickery. That dollar goes directly into your pocket. So that's money saved, and that's something that you can actually measure with accounting, so it doesn't look like Tom's playing voodoo with the numbers, right? Because he has to make it look good. Nope, it's company-driven numbers, PM, accounting. You guys figured out what is the actual savings. That goes directly into your pocket. And then, of course, with leadership, you can do whatever you want with that savings, right? Reduce your prices, have more pizza parties, and do whatever you want to do.
So I'm interested because, Shabini, that you've got to have experienced this now, and you get to overlay it with Tom's experience. So maybe give some of those tangible pieces where you've seen it and went, yeah, that worked for us, or we should have done that even. I love that because, you know, it's like, oh, I wish I'd have known that then. I might have looked at that differently.
Years ago, it was looking at each individual department. How do we make accounting more function? Operate more efficiently? How do we get purchasing and the purchase orders out the door faster and the invoices pay? How do we get detailing to, you know, align better and all that? So we were looking at individual solutions and maybe even some value stream mapping within each department. Now what I see, the value I see, and I try to explain to my clients, is start to finish, right? So from when the order comes in, being the project is awarded, to when we close out that project. So what we call order to cash, right? We receive the order, we get paid for the order. And instead of looking at it by department now, we're looking at what is the workflow of the project? How can we make the project more efficient, regardless of what division or what process touches that, right? So when we back off and we start to look at it that way, now we can start to say, okay, here's how we're currently operating, because what we do is build projects. So let's look at the process of the project, not just the accounting department. The process of the project, here's how we do it now. That's value stream mapping. We can look at what does the future state look like if we want to add more efficiencies, or what's working, what's not working. Then we can say, okay, now we know how we want to operate. What software solutions are out there to help us smooth this flow out a little bit?
That's poignant, because we do look at, oh, well, my department does this, my department does that, and we're super efficient. But Tom kind of said it before, it doesn't really matter if I'm really, really efficient here, but I'm just chucking it over the fence and it's not efficient in the end, and it's not driving value back to the organization. And we do think vertically, and you have to think a bit vertically, but without forgetting the horizontal of we're delivering a project. And I just saw this at MCAA Fab with the Binsky team, is that exactly what you talked about, Tom. There is this handoff portion, and so much of the efficiencies gained by better tooling in a shop, by better digital tools in detailing, that's lost in the handoff to the next piece of the organization or of the process. It's like, hey, I'm able to weld and do this many welds, but I can't get it handed off to get the rest of the fabrication done. Great. What good is that?
That's when the weight game starts, right? That's detailing's fault. Well, the estimators missed that.
That's detail's problem. That's, well, the people down the line are no good, or the welds aren't coming fast enough. And all of a sudden we get to pointing fingers, and that's what you were going at, Thomas, that we need a culture that's focused on, hey, we see a bottleneck. This is an opportunity, not, you know, problems become opportunities, not become the blame game. And man, we love the stick
oh,
of
yeah.
the blame game.
So a couple of examples, right? So I was at MCAA. I was lucky enough to open up the conference on Tuesday, representing Maxim there. And a couple of slides that resonated with a lot of people. One of them was this efficiency thing. So I said, hey, look, I got a 5-step process and they're all hitting 90%. So in school, right, we're all trained 90%. Hey, that's an 80. I'm doing good. But yield is a multiplication problem. So 0.9 times 0.9 times 0.9. So 5.9 equals a 59. So as an organization, I'm only 60% deficiency. So I have a failing grade. But do people put those together? The other thing is we're not talking, we're talking Kaizen, right? Another lean word for incremental improvements. If each one of those 5 steps just gets 5% better, so a 5% increase, so 90 to 95, now 95 times 5 is a 0.79. So just in a 5% incremental increase in efficiency within each department, I just gained 18 points in efficiency for my organization. So we're not talking about moving mountains. Right. We're not talking about, some crazy thought experiments that we have to go through. This is using tested, tried, proven techniques that have been around. You know, I like to joke that the pyramids were prefabbed. Right. They didn't build those giant, blocks on the sand. Right. They did that way downriver and then floated them all up. The Eiffel Tower was prefab. That was in the late 1800s. So. This prefab idea is not even new. But although a lot of us think in those terms, like, hey, I'm thinking about doing prefab. But, oh my gosh, really?
Yeah, that is a mindset that still surprises me. But we see it a lot.
And look, it's nobody's fault, right? I'm not looking to assign blame. Please know my heart here, right? It's they haven't gone through that transition. Manufacturing got their butts kicked, right? When we thought quality controls wasn't important. So we kicked Dr. Deming, basically the godfather of a lot of these things in the United States, and he went off to Japan. Well, guess what Japan did? They embraced it. And then they came back and they kicked our butts when it came into the automotive system, right? Everybody knows the Toyota production system. So because they embraced everything that was going on, they inevitably just kicked our butts. And then we started to do it. But manufacturing went through that transition. Construction hasn't. So now what I see is exactly what you two are talking about is this one thing, this one tool, this one thing here, this one thing here, and then try to piecemealing it all together versus having this, hey, man, let's take a step back. Let's fundamentally understand what we are, who we are, why we are, how we are. And then, all right, let's apply these tools, right? I mean, we go right to the tool, and right now they're going right to the automatic tool, which, just scares me a little bit.
Well, I'm interested in, because we hear this a lot, like, well, we can get to, really efficient fabrication, but, everything's a little bit different. Every project is different. Every architect is different. Every engineer is a little different. So, in the Toyota, environment, we're building pretty much the same car over and over and over, and we're getting better and better. And I said that earlier and you laughed. Explain what your perspective is on that, because I think that's going to be real interesting. And again, this is where I'm glad they can't throw anything at us right now, because they're probably throwing things at the screen.
Okay, so just real quick, I did laugh at you, right? I was just chuckling because I do hear that a lot. And I hear that everywhere. I don't care where you are. I mean, I've helped people like in wine distribution. Oh, you don't understand our process, Tom, because this isn't manufacturing or whatever. It's like, oh my gosh, you can teach business globally. So there's got to be some kind of uniformity there. You can teach sales, as a college course. It's like, for Pete's sakes, this isn't different. But anyway, yes. Think about Dell. This is how I like to explain it to my clients. Dell came up with this ingenious idea that they can make you feel like you got this unique laptop designed specifically for you. And how did they do it? Hey, you want, the size of your monitor, and they give you 3 choices. Hey, how much horsepower do you want? Here's the kind of RAM and memory.
pick one, or, you know, out of three or four choices. So out of all of those little pull down menus that they do three to four to five of, you can almost get a unique combination specifically for you. So what did they good at? Making those three or four choices. So within a prefab shop, for instance, if you're an M, right, you're cutting, you're stamping, you're bending. So instead of getting, you know, caught up in the verbiage of my product is different, but my process is all the same. Everybody has the same tools in their shops. The E on MEP. Everybody bends, everybody cuts, everybody terminates, you know, everybody assembles. So get really good at that and pick a few of those products that you build from that. So if I get really good at my process, I don't care what I'm building because that should be the output. See, in business, your inputs should predict your outputs, not my inputs pray and I hope something comes out that works. Never in a business course did I ever see that in writing that says, here's some inputs, pray. Don't get me wrong, I think prayer is beautiful. And then I hope I get what I need, right? Inputs should predict outputs. And then we try to measure when that doesn't happen.
That's like one of our directors, Stephanie at Maxim. She said, hope is not a strategy. And a lot of us are hanging on to hope. I hope it works out.
Yep. I hope the shop can handle this. I hope we can produce it more efficiently.
Well, I hope it works in the field, right? I mean, we hear that a lot. And that's where that handoff comes in. So quick example on the handoff. We solve for one company 80% of their handoff problems between the shop and the field just by the header. Because, hey, the field says, hey, man, I need you to design this part for me. I mean, these guys are wizards at drawing that thing and dimensioning it and what color they want. You know what they really don't do well? Hey, what's your contact number? What address do you want me to send this to? When do you need this by? What's the charge code that I should charge so I can do this work and get paid for? All of those silly things. And so what we try to do, or at least what we try to do here with our clients, is we try to mimic what you do in real life to what you're going to do at work so that you don't have to learn a new process. For instance, try to order something on Amazon and not put all the digits for your credit card. Try to order something on Amazon and not put your phone number, right? Those are just what we call the header, right? It's not the part that you're trying to buy or the whatever, but that dang header that you have to get right so that the person building it or trying to execute on it knows where it has to go, how it's being paid, what is it, quantity, et cetera, so you get exactly what you want.
That's crazy.
The basics. Yeah. It is crazy, right, Shabini?
The stuff you take for granted. Yeah. Everybody knows what job that is, right? Because as a PM or the foreman, that's your only job. You forget that most of the other company has no idea what that job number is.
Just now think about that frustration that it causes when a shop has to go back to the field, which is an inefficiency, right? Because I got data. I didn't get it right. I got to do a do loop, costing us money. And now I'm like, you know, aggravating the heck out of the people there saying, oh my gosh, it's just too difficult to deal with. You don't know my phone number. You know, you don't know where the address is. It's just,
Well, and there's this appearance of I don't care, right? This is like, wait, because you just said that, Shabini, like I have my one job, right? So this is my world. This is my baby. And you don't know my baby and you don't care. But it's not really that I don't care. It's that I've got a lot of babies to handle right now and you're all important. You're all special, but I really need all of that information. And you're taking some of that like feeling out of it and saying like, hey, here's the basic information that's required to get anything to happen. And it's probably pretty easy for them in the process to set it up and get going. And then I like that, Thomas, that iteration loop of going back and forth and how much time that costs a company and how much frustration it builds.
Right.
And it creates an opportunity for people to go around the process. And that's when we really break down.
You know, I always like to say when we get in a room and everybody wants to do this, they want to blame each other and all that. I'm like, okay, look at this. It's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault. It's my fault. Are we all good with blame? So let's get to the business of trying to get this done. But I actually had a client and the shop manager, he was getting frustrated because people were calling him up and asking him for work. And he was like, well, they don't understand, like you said, a PM has one job for 3-5 years, right? Where the shop manager is probably running 10, 15, 20, depending upon the size. So he's like, they don't even care that I'm doing a whole bunch of different projects. And I'm like, just think about it for a second. If we were an outside entity selling something and you keep getting customers calling you up, are you getting angry because they keep asking you for stuff? No, of course not, because it's work. It's keeping us employed. So again, that mind shift works on both sides, right? It's not, I'm not looking to blame the field. Like I said, there's blame to go around for everyone. Can we get to the business of solving for this?
That was my own aha moment in my own career. We were in an issue, a critical issue, and a leader was trying to get the reason why this all happened out of me while I'm in the middle of the firefight. And I turned to him and I said, I can do one of two things. I can explain to you how we got here, or I can fix it and we can worry about blame later. And he was like, fix it? And I went and I fixed it, and it was fixed, and we figured out what the problem was and we fixed it. And I turned around afterwards and I came back to him and he's all died down. And I'm like, so the problem really doesn't matter. It's fixed, right? Yeah. Okay. So see, blame's not important. I could blame this system and that person and this. But again, like you said, blame, there's plenty of that to go around and we can waste all of our time doing that. Or we can just say, listen, let's get after improvement. And that's the shift, the mind shift from the old way to continuous improvement to a culture of, oh my gosh, Shabini just brought me a problem. Let's celebrate that she found an inefficiency that, hey, can you add this to the header and my life will get a lot better. And you highlighted something else there. There is this, like, I say this in the software, so I'll go to the software side. Like, there is this belief that we're fighting against each other. And I'm like, no. Right. I don't get to exist if you don't get to exist and do what right. You do. So if I don't make what you do better and you don't help me make what I do better, we both lose.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a symbiotic relationship, people. We want to succeed.
Right.
So I think the shops have to believe in that. I think the field, and, you know, there's this, I used to highlight it, you know, we used to call this an accounting industry that dabbles in building things. I wish I didn't say that as much as I did, although I do believe that the software really focused too much on that. We pushed too much down. I'll still go on that. But if we don't focus on gathering the money, so that header probably has information on where to charge the materials to, where who to invoice, probably has some checks and balances so we get paid. So by the way, field, we don't, you know, you have to install it to get paid, but if they don't process it and do it correctly in the form that it's supposed to be placed in, we don't get paid. We don't get paid. We don't get to play. So there is that blame game and that business process, Thomas, goes much farther. And Shabini, I know you have experience with this. It goes so much farther into the organization than understanding the value at each point in that value chain.
Yes. Just within the last year, a mechanical contractor, electrical, MEP, let's just say MEP, over $300 million. And the executive vice president said, we're an accounting firm that happens to do construction. Wow, that's crazy, right? And then the more we dug into it, they had such tight financial controls and processes and procedures that only the accounting department knew. What they were failing to realize is without giving some of that information over to the project management team, they were unable to really truly forecast where their projects were going to end up. So you have this like margin gain and fade, right? Because they thought by, you know, having these tight processes control around the accounting, we can keep an eye on the money. Well, guess what? The money's not being made in the accounting department. It's what you just said, Jeff. It's being made out in the field. And they didn't have visibility into that. So I agree. That company firm was an accounting company that happened to dabble in construction.
And that's where Thomas is right, that problem exists in every industry. And I have been in every one of them along the way in some way, shape, or form. And that problem of accounting controls being too strict to understand and allow, and actually creates waste, right? Because there's so many tight accounting controls, they're not accounting for the factor that it's taking more time, and time is money. One of my favorite things we did really, really early on is I did a study with a company and I asked them about all the accounting procedures and looking at different invoices. And we figured out that the time in which it was taking them to process any invoice under, I think it was $50, if they just approved it, even if they were approving ones that weren't right, it was worth the money to do it.
Yep. I believe that.
Gone through that process a few times, and just to run an invoice or to put a PO through a system, depending upon their size, I've gotten numbers of $200 to $500 to put in a PO. And if you don't realize that, every PO, that's $500. That's $500. That's $500, right? So.
Yeah, and that creates this opportunity to create a system that allows those things to be processed in an automated fashion and get enough information to the field to make that process seamless, faster, then you actually are doing some checks and balances still without creating all those controls. So,
and it's opportunity for training and learning, right? You just said it. Look, training is probably the number one thing that we can do for our employees to make them want to stay, right? We all complain about shortage of manpower or whatever for our industry. People bounce a lot. But training or taking a vested interest in these individuals, if I have a foreman that can put in a PO once a month that because he's planned out his job versus a foreman that puts in 14 POs a week because he's doing it as he goes, the organization isn't doing anybody a favor by not retraining or up the training of this one foreman to teach him how to plan that individual way, because it becomes more efficient for the organization and it helps him, because 14,000 POs in a week, he's got to be going crazy trying to juggle all of those balls. So by supporting that individual through proper training, it goes a mile to keeping that person who wants to stay there with you.
You hit a number of different things there too, that PO once a month. If it is set up in such a way that you're gathering the information along the way in a seamless pace, like this is what drives me absolutely crazy. Expenses are the same thing, right? Like understanding what it takes to do expenses on any level, in any place, at any company, and really looking at how can I make that so that the end of the month isn't this 5-10 hour process for people to get those expenses in. Again, time is money. If you can make it seamless by understanding that at the end of the month, it's just click and I'm done. Wow, we all win, right? And I'm actually going to watch my expenses more and I'm going to be able to see what's going on more. So a lot of this is ubiquitous. So, but we've hit that point where I need you to give, each of you to give a final, like, what's the advice you give to anybody listening that's like, hey, I think they're right, but I don't know where to start. So, Shubini, where would you tell them to start?
Write down your processes as they are now. Whether you like them or not, just write them down so you have somewhere to start. And then you can focus on how do we make this better. For right now, first step, write down your processes. And you don't even have to do it yourself. Delegate that down to the people that actually do the work. What are your processes?
Spend the time to document it. Thomas, you've been the guide in this one. What is your advice?
So start with a strategy. You got to have a vision. So a strategy development. And then from that strategy development, produce a SWOT analysis on yourself. Because from there, you know, like a strength taken to an extreme can become a weakness. So be careful. Obviously, you're going to understand your weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. But that all comes from a strategy development, which to me just all leads to leadership. Leadership, leadership, leadership matters. I like to joke around that, you know, Usain Bolt has got a coach that looks like me, right? This, you know, fat old gray guy that probably has never run a day in his life, training the world's fastest human being. Leadership matters. Leadership matters.
I love it. That is the mic drop moment. Let everybody know where they can go learn a little bit more about each of you, although we'll have your LinkedIns in the show notes. So check those out. But where can they go catch up with you and learn a little bit more?
MaximConsulting.com, and then email is probably the best way, and LinkedIn. Yeah, yep. S. Alford, MaximConsulting.com.
That's right. I like it. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you for joining me today, guys.
Thank you, Jeff.
And thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Thomas Santos and Shabini Alford. To read all our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontentcrew.com. This is The Content Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.